Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. I am Ursula Rudenberg, your host today, and thank you for listening in. It's good to have you with us. Quick look at the weather for this weekend. It's sunny and nice today, but this weekend is not looking that way. It's 50% chance of rain both on Saturday and Sunday, although temperatures will stay in the high 50s and low 60s. Sun is not really predicted until Wednesday of next week. So are you getting stir crazy too? I don't know about you, but I can't wait for spring. We have an amaryllis at KHOI sitting in the front room, and it's been here for almost 3 years, almost since we moved into the Pantorium. And over the winter, it lost all its leaves and was left for dead in the corner of the room, and no one had gotten around to actually throwing it away. And then all of a sudden, 2 weeks ago, a tall stem shot up out of the shriveled stump. And this week, two enormous pink and white flowers bloomed at the top. So spring is coming. It's very encouraging and inspiring. By the way, whoever brought the pink hyacinth and put it next to the amaryllis, thank you. It looks and smells really wonderful. So there are signs of spring. Probably by the middle of next week, we'll be seeing sun, and it'll be possible to go outside and start to see what's happening. In the second half of the hour, Mary Rankin, Director of Sustainability at Iowa State University, will be here with Jeff Witt, ISU Utilities Director. Right now, Lindsay Nissen is here with us. Welcome, Lindsay.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Put you a little closer to the mic.
All right.
Lindsay is a Ames resident. And she's an artist and a community builder and a visionary. Lindsay is here to talk about Reliable Street.
Yes.
So what is Reliable Street, you may ask? So Lindsay, what is Reliable Street?
Well, Reliable Street is a place in Ames. It's just on the northwest corner in the old town of Ontario. So it's basically the last street before you get out of Ames. And it's named Reliable Street after the old Ames Reliable Feeds, which was the original place that housed the giant mill that still stands on the property. So,
otherwise known by many as the Doughboy.
Yes, the Doughboy
Grainville Elevator.
So,
yeah,
the Reliable Street project is that building and warehouse that we're going to transform into a new community slash art space.
Okay, back up for a minute.
Yeah.
you just said a whole lot.
I said a lot.
There used to be a town of Ontario, which in my memory was separate from Ames.
Yes.
Today it's the western edge of Ames, the northwestern edge of Ames.
Yep.
And you're talking about the Doughboy Grain Elevator, which is probably the tallest building on that part of town.
Definitely on that part of town, the tallest building.
And it's an old grain elevator.
Mm-hmm. It's a six-story grain elevator that was built in 1955.
Okay, so what happened that there can be an art center in there? How do you get access to the grain elevator?
Well, we purchased the elevator after the previous owner passed away. He was the import car dealer, not dealer, but he worked on import cars. So he just had a little import car business in the warehouse part of the building, and then the mill sort of sat stagnant since it closed in 1979.
So it hasn't been a grain elevator since 1979.
No. Yeah. Uh-huh. So.
And how recently did you buy the building?
We acquired the building in December, so hasn't been too long. But.
So it's a brand new project.
Yes.
It's a big investment to make.
It is. But I think a lot of people saw it sort of as an unwanted building. So, we acquired it pretty easily. Nobody really wanted it. So,
Do you think it was in danger of being torn down?
I don't think so because it's
a lot of work.
It would have cost more to tear it down than anybody was willing to invest, because that thing's built like a rock.
Does it have land around it?
The property is a little over an acre. It goes to the railroad tracks all the way to the road. It's kind of a triangle-shaped lot.
So, again, to be clear, we're talking about the building when you go west out of Ames on Ontario Road.
Yes.
And then when you get to the intersection of Ontario and North and South Dakota,
yes,
right where the school is,
mm-hmm.
You see there at the crossroads, just a little bit west of there, is the large grain elevator.
Yeah. So if you stop at that stop sign on Ontario and North Dakota and go north, It's right there up on your left, so uh-huh. right before the railroad tracks.
Unfortunately, we're not there right now. Yeah. It would have been great to be in the building to have you show sure. it. But can you describe a little bit what the building's like? What's it made out of? How does it look inside right now?
Sure. Well, there's two pieces of the property. There's the old warehouse where they used to store feed. So that is a two-story warehouse that's about 8,000 square feet with on both levels together. Which is just a really, really big flat space on the top. And then the bottom is sort of sectioned off, and that's where he had his import car business. You can see the garage doors and stuff still on the outside. And then that connects to the larger concrete structure, which is the mill, and that's all poured concrete, and six stories, reinforced with rebar, and that is literally a mess.
Where, so when you walk in there, can you see all the way to the top?
Yeah, in parts of it you can.
So it's like a huge silo in a way, right?
Yes. The big flat rectangle part that you see that's just has no windows is all silos. So if you get underneath there, you can look straight all the way up to the top.
So it's a big dark space? Is that what it looks like in there?
Uh-huh. So, yeah. So that's a big dark space. And then the other part is little rooms, and you can climb up the stairs and go all the way up to the top. And mm-hmm. there's different levels. We're not sure exactly what all that was used for, mm-hmm. but we're gathering information slowly.
And what's it like in there right now?
It's a mess. I mean, it's pigeons live in there mostly.
Is there furniture in it? Is there
not in the mill part? So the other part, the warehouse, you know, it was mostly he actually lived in there. So that has a lot of old car parts, his old cars, tools, things for working on cars, air compressors, all kinds of stuff, which we were really excited about because we can use a lot of that in our projects. But
how are you going to use them?
Well, the tools, and they have like welding stations and things like that. So we're planning on putting in like an artist workshop, and, you know, and there's just a bunch of things that we can use. Mm-hmm. And as artists, we see a lot of that as being material to build stuff out of rather than just total garbage. Yeah.
Well, before you get into the vision of that, sorry. Just one more question. Yeah. Is the building itself structurally sound?
It is. We had an engineer come in before we purchased the building to look at the mill and the warehouse, and he basically said it would take a lot to make that thing go down. So, everything's structurally sound. It's just going to be a lot of work repairing uh-huh. and cleaning and getting it all ready for public use.
For public use.
Yeah.
This is why I introduced Lindsay as a visionary.
Yes.
So what's the vision?
What's the vision?
Why did you buy this thing?
Well, in my art practice, I deal a lot with the idea of making art from a place and really owning your place as your culture and taking that and making art out of it. And I just see this building as sort of a symbol of our culture. It's obviously no longer in use, and it's an eyesore, and that's the way it's seen. But to me, it's symbolic of, you know, it's something that has passed, and we want to use it to sort of turn it into the future.
Taking stock of a building that's been part of the landscape for many years.
Yeah.
And repurposing it so that it still has new meaning.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And the beautiful thing about this building is everybody who's lived in Ames has a story about it. Like, I don't know. Like,
well, this is our story.
Yeah, exactly.
KHOI story.
Yeah.
Our antenna. We have four antennas
that
we use to get from our studio here in Douglas Avenue out to Story City, which is where our tower is.
Yeah.
And one of our four antennas is on top of the Doughboy.
Right?
So that's our story. So you're technically one of our landlords.
Yeah, right? Right?
I guess there's a lot of radio antennas.
There are, yes. There's several cell phone and radio antennas on the building, which...
Because it's tall.
Yes, because it's tall and it, you know, blocks the wind. So we have Verizon, AT&T, all these...
So are we going to have to start paying you rent for being on the building?
I don't think so. Those are very complicated, all the leases and things that go
It's a source of income, though, actually.
Yes. Yeah, so we get some revenue from the towers.
Before we go into the vision for this, I did a little bit research about the area. Yeah. Should we talk about that for a minute?
Yeah, let's do it.
Okay. There first was a town called New Philadelphia.
Yes.
Which was south of where Ontario was. And it was laid out in 1855. So it was a little bit concurrent with the beginning of Iowa State in that period of time?
I think so, yeah.
It only had a feeble existence up until the point where the railroad came through. And when the railroad station was created, a new town was set up, which today, in 1869, which is the town called Ontario.
Yeah.
And it continued to grow. And then it then swallowed up the town of New Philadelphia, which was just about a half a mile south of there. Everything. And there's no traces left of that because I've never seen anything.
Yeah, I don't think so.
If you drive on North Dakota, you don't, or South Dakota, I guess it's kind of maybe like where the water tower used to be, that area.
Sure,
maybe.
Yeah.
And then Ontario, it says Ontario, this is taken from the Ames History Center website. Ontario was a pleasantly situated town on the Chicago Northwestern Railroad, and it was surrounded by a most excellent and beautiful portion of country with good forests.
Yeah. If you look at the pictures, you see it was very wooded over in there. It was a pretty beautiful place.
It was on an elevated plain, and it was, like you said, surrounded by woods. And it was 10 miles east of Boone and almost 2 miles northwest of what was then Iowa State College. So it was kind of happening at the same time.
Yeah.
And the first buildings were two stores erected by Enoch Thurman and his brother and Hiram Scott and his brother. And Hiram Scott named the town after his previous home in Ontario, Ohio. I always wondered where that name Ontario came
from.
Yeah,
right.
The structure, their stores were destroyed by fire, but others were soon built, and the town grew very quickly. So a successful little town. And actually, I remember Jeff Benson telling me that Ontario Road is one of the oldest roads in the area.
Oh, really?
And that's why it's part of the Lincoln Highway, because it was a very, very old road, preceded most roads in Ames.
Yeah.
Then there were several branches of early businesses, including stores with dry goods and groceries, boots, shoes, drugs, medicines, hardware, a restaurant, lumber, wagon making, blacksmithing, tailoring, a physician, and a hotel. So that's quite a metropolis.
Yeah, right?
Yeah.
There's not much left.
There's not much of that left. You don't see that. One of the buildings left is the building that the Winklers, Winkler has his painting business in.
I think that's the only one besides the elevator.
Yeah. One of the finest depot buildings on the line of the railroad was located there. There's not a trace of the depot, is there?
No. You can see it in the old photographs. It was on the property, and it was real close to the railroad tracks, just to the east of the warehouse. So,
does it look like a fine building?
It looks like a fine building.
Okay. They tried many times to incorporate Ontario.
Yes.
But it didn't happen, and in 1962 it was annexed by Ames. And today, if you mention somebody being in the town of Ontario, they look at you blankly.
Yes.
And they say, oh, I live in Ames.
Yeah, right.
So in the spring of 1869 or 1870, a large and fine steam flouring mill, three stories high, was completed. And that would be your building. The Lockwood Grain and Coal Company opened it in April of 1898.
Yes. Well, that was the original building.
Which is not the building we have today.
No, not the building we have today.
Okay. And that's because there was a fire.
Yes, there were several fires.
Okay. So the original building had an elevator, warehouse, coal house, and five cribs.
Yep.
And the name changed to Farmers Grain Company in 1916 with new owners. And then William Barr and his son Charlie Barr owned the Ames Reliable from May of 1924 to August of 1963. So they're the people that named it Reliable.
Yes, exactly. That's where we get the Reliable Street. So yeah.
It's a wonderful name.
Yeah, I know.
Could not ask for a nicer name for a new project.
I agree.
A fire destroyed the old elevator in 1928. After which a small plant was built employing the latest mechanical improvements of the day. So it was a groundbreaker in technology. And this was expanded until 1955 with a $500,000 concrete feed mill, which was built, which is what we see today.
That's the one.
This was known at the time as the most modern livestock and poultry feed plant in the world.
Yeah.
When it was built.
I think that's really interesting, and it has a lot of historical value. I mean,
it's historic.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was equipped with push-button controls.
They're still in there.
Awesome. They're still in there?
Yeah, they took a lot of stuff away, but the push buttons are still there. Yeah.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
And they were made to mix and match feed.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And the capacity was 200 tons of feed per day. And the concrete building is 128 feet high, 126 feet long, and 52 feet wide with six working floors.
Mm-hmm.
And the Doughboy industry bought the plant in August of 1963, therefore the name Doughboy,
yep.
Which is how I always knew it,
yeah.
operating until the structure was retired in June of 1979.
Mm-hmm.
So now there's more to write at the bottom of the history.
Yeah, right.
In 2015,
mm-hmm.
the building was bought by Lindsay Nissen and company and became a renowned art center.
Yeah.
the cultural mecca of Western Ames.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's talk about the vision.
Let's talk about the vision. Well, first of all, the area, because it was a separate town, it has, you know, sort of this feeling of being not a part of Ames, and there's not really any services in the area. I think the closest thing you can get to is Hy-Vee. And or like the come and go on the corner. So really that community is underserved, and they don't have what we call a third place, which is a place where you can walk to and, you know, hang out, run into your neighbors, and sort of get these community juices flowing. So the vision, to start, is a coffee shop, which is going to be owned and operated by Sharon Stewart, who has been a close friend of mine and has been in the service industry for her whole life. And it's been a dream of hers to run a coffee shop. And she's really interested in building community, in giving people a place, in having affordable things. So it's not just the person who wants the $5 latte who can come in, but it's somebody who can come and get, you know, a dollar a cup of coffee too. So we're really interested in bringing that community that's around the area into this space. And then the next facet of that is an art gallery. So the art gallery and the coffee shop will be connected or just slightly separated. So by bringing people in with the coffee shop, we're also in a way exposing them to art. Because a lot of times art can be, you know, kind of scary and people don't know how to approach it. But a coffee shop is something that we all are familiar with, and it's a space that we can enter and not feel like we don't belong. So the coffee shop and the gallery are really the first two things that are going to go in on the main floor. And then a workshop that's going to focus on woodworking, welding, and technology, and all those together. So there's not really a space in Ames that offers classes in technology, programming, you know, building things like robots and interesting things like that. So
that's kind of like a makerspace?
Kind of like a makerspace, but more focused on actually having classes and workshops. A lot of makerspaces are you just go in and work, mm-hmm. and you kind of already know what you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
So we want to focus on actually teaching those things and, like, practical skills, like building a box mm-hmm. that you can stand on, like things that are practical. And
who will teach?
Me and Austin Stewart, who is also an Iowa State professor in the visual arts department. He works a lot with new technology and mixing that in with art. So those are the first two people going to be doing that, but I'm assuming that's going to grow.
Mm-hmm.
So,
and what's your time frame for those first projects?
Well, we'd like to have the gallery going by this summer because it doesn't require as much. We just have to clean up the gallery space, paint the walls, and get the restrooms going. But the coffee shop we'd like to have going by the first of next year, so January 2017, and hopefully the workshop will be right there with it. So that's our vision for now. We just
and the long term vision.
Well, we just applied for an Art Place grant, which is a nationwide art grant organization to redo the second floor, mm-hmm. which we'd like to model it after a small town gym. So like high school gyms that had the basketball floor, but then also had the stage for theater events and things like that. So essentially that will be like a big flat space. And you can do, you know, host events, weddings. We imagine like maybe flea markets, dances, roller skating, skateboarding, all kinds of things in that second floor space. Just a big community flat space that we can do multiple different kinds of projects. That's in the 5-year plan. The mill is sort of the 20-year plan, because that needs a lot of work to even let people in there to be safe, because it's hasn't been touched, as I said, since 1979. So it's got some problems.
So are you eventually envisioning a studio space in the building as well?
Yeah, I think in the workshop space we'll be able to start, you know, getting studio space in there. It's hard to sort of imagine right now, because we don't know how much, you know, space
so it's
we
a,
have.
So it's a big project.
Oh, yeah.
Really, really big project.
It's a big project. So, uh-huh.
So how many years are you going to dedicate to this project?
This is a lifetime one. So I'm here to stay.
You're here to stay?
Yeah.
What's the very first thing that you're doing?
What's the very first thing? Well, right now we're just cleaning. As I was saying, it's full of things. We've been going through car parts, and there's a lot of stuff that you know, he had around. I think he was in there for over 20 years, so he was collecting things, and his son didn't really want any of that, so. Right now we're just cleaning, and we're trying to get electricity working, right? So it's been moving really slow. Since we didn't have electricity, we don't have heat, you know, and it was winter. So now it's starting to warm up, and I think we're going to be able to get in there and start doing a lot more. But, yeah, putting bathrooms in and getting the gallery going is my main goal.
So when you walk into this building and you look around and think this is – you know, my building.
Yeah.
How does that feel?
It feels great. I mean, it's very surreal, because it's just such an icon I'm in awe every time I go there. I'm like, that's ours. We have this building, you know. Uh-huh. But I think it's gonna really be good for that side of town, that neighborhood, and also the arts community, because we don't really have a place that's ours that we can congregate, a big space to put on all these events. There's so many talented people in this town that have ideas and want to get together and collaborate and work on projects together. So I really imagine it being this very collaborative space, and, you know, empowering people to, you know, do what they want to do and do what they love, like starting their own business. Obviously, Sharon's going to be doing that with the coffee shop. Yeah, making your life here, taking ownership of your place, I think, is really a big part of it. So, yeah, we want to encourage people to be doing that.
So, Lindsay, how would you describe yourself?
Describe myself?
Yeah. I mean, okay, let me be a little bit less big about that. Are you from Ames?
I am from Ames. Mm-hmm. I actually grew up just outside of Ames, and I went to Gilbert, so I didn't actually go to Ames school.
And what is your background professionally?
I'm a visual artist. I just recently got my graduate degree in visual arts from Iowa State. So, yeah, I'm really focused on the visual arts, but I'm also really interested in how you make that sustainable, whether it be through business or through community. And I feel like we can really make art sustainable, but a community needs to support as artists. And I think that Reliable Street is really going to showcase the talent and it's going to be able to, like, put us on display so the community can sort of come around and support us, because I think we have a lot to offer, and it's important. It's important.
So if somebody wants to ask you about more about it, is there some way that they can contact you or somebody about the project?
Let's see. We're working on our website right now. I'm not sure if it's just a splash page right now or if we actually have the contact information, but all that's going up here soon.
So and I guess if you Googled Reliable Street, would you find your website?
Yes. Yep.
Okay.
And, yeah, Facebook too, and I think we're on Instagram and that, but really, here coming up, we're going to be out there a lot, so we just keep telling people. Yeah.
Okay.
If you see a light on or if you see us, yeah, come say hi. And
so you just drive out on Ontario Road and you can't miss the green elevator.
Oh, no.
It's the biggest building around.
Yes, it is.
So, Lindsay, as we end this segment, you mentioned at the beginning of the interview that you had a strong feeling about a sense of place.
Yes.
You had written a very beautiful song kind of alludes to that.
Yes.
About our river here.
Yes.
Would you sing that before you leave?
I will.
Okay. Jonah is going to fix you up with the mic.
Yeah, I did a lot of my graduate research studies on Grant Wood, and that was sort of his biggest talking point was making art from your place, about your place. So this is a song I wrote about the Skunk River, which, it's warming up. I'm probably going to get out there today.
I
Thank you, Lindsay.
Yes.
Where did you write that song?
Where did I write that song? Oh, I'm not sure if I remember. I mean, it was definitely at the river, and I don't know if I just wrote the lyrics at the river or the actual song part, but yeah.
Well, thank you. It's very beautiful.
Thank
you. It's kind of an anthem.
Yes. It is.
Yeah. So for our river.
Right.
We've been speaking with Lindsay Nissen about Reliable Street, which is a project out on the western edge of town in the old Doughboy grain elevator. And this is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. I'm your host, Ursula Rudenberg. And we've been talking about a project that has a sense of place and history.
Yes.
And any last words, Lindsay, before you take off about the vision behind this?
You know, I want everybody to know in the community that they're a part of it, and we want you to participate. So if there's any way that you can help, let us know, and we'll figure it out. So, yeah.
Okay, well, so we're speaking with Lindsay Nissen, a longtime resident of Ames and artist, and looks like you're here to stay because you've got a big project ahead of you.
We do.
And when do you think the coffee shop will open?
Hopefully in January of 2017. So,
okay.
But I'd like the gallery to be open this summer.
Okay.
So.
And will there be food too?
Yes, the coffee shop will have food. Simple things, but yeah, she's going to do food for sure.
Okay.
She's already sourcing local vegetables from Julia Slocum, so they're planning on how she can plant more to supply the coffee shop and all that. So,
okay.
Yeah.
Okay, well, thank you.
Yes.
Thank you for coming by and come again sometime.
Yes, of course.
Okay,
thanks for having me.
Yeah.
Yes, I appreciate it.
Take care.
Yeah, you too.
And Elliot's here too. Hello, Elliot.
Yeah.
Say hello real fast.
Hello.
Elliot, former board member and Lindsay's husband, actually. Been listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, and I'm your host for today, Ursula Rudenberg, and Mary Rankin is here. You're the Iowa State Sustainability Director.
Yes, that's correct. And I also get to do work with the city as their sustainability coordinator, so it's really two interesting hats I get to wear.
You also brought a guest with you. Would you introduce him?
I'm very happy to. I try to bring different guests and highlight different things going on, both in the community and the university. And as we get closer to Earth Month, so that's just next month, I thought it would be really interesting to look at some of the more traditional pieces of sustainability, maybe, from an environmental sustainability perspective, from the university hat standpoint. So with that in mind, I thought, let's look at energy.
Okay.
And our energy guru at Iowa State University, beyond anything you can imagine, the guy who powers Psy, right, Jeff, is with us today. Jeff Witt is the utilities director at Iowa State University, and I'm thrilled to have him with us today.
And we've been speaking history in the first part of the show. We were talking about how the town of Ontario was built in 1855. So, trivia question, do you know when Iowa State was built?
Do I know?
Well, I'm asking the listener.
Oh, okay. All right. I'm sorry.
So, yes, you guessed that it was 1858. We know that you know that.
All right.
But did you know that it, and again, I'm not asking you, Mary.
Okay,
you know
okay, this, I'll be quiet.
But you, listener, thank you for staying with us. And did you know that Iowa State has always provided its own utilities since its inception? Ah, you didn't know that. So here to talk about the energy production at Iowa State is Mary Rankin and Jeff Witt.
Good morning.
Good morning. So can you give us a little history of that journey of powering Psi?
As was mentioned, university started in 1858. Utilities was a lot simpler back then. There was no electricity. When you wanted air conditioning, you opened the windows. And they burned the coal or wood in stoves and fireplaces to heat the buildings. So that was – the utility systems were very simple, very local to the buildings at that point. That began to change. Thomas Edison actually mailed light bulbs to the university in 1880. So they started to make electricity and light buildings at that point. But ultimately, they built the first power plant in 1891 to provide campus – the entire campus with energy. And that power plant burned coal in boilers and made steam and used steam to run a steam engine to provide electricity. And then the waste steam off that engine was used to heat the buildings.
So how long did Iowa State go without actually having electricity?
1858 till about 1880.
Wow, so that's a long time.
Something like that, yeah.
That's a long time.
They used gas lamps or kerosene lamps and things like that.
Wow, amazing.
So that plant in 1891 used a process called cogeneration, and that means you use a fuel source and simultaneously produce electricity and thermal energy or steam at that time. Very efficient process, which is why it was picked.
Mm-hmm.
And that process is what we use today. Same process. Technology has changed.
Mm-hmm. But the system has stayed the same, basically?
The theory behind the system and the efficiency of the system has stayed the same.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think it's such an interesting process, and that certainly was one of the most interesting things I discovered when I came to Iowa State was just all of the thought given to efficiency within our utility system and just even learning about the whole code generation piece. It's, I think, what did you guys spend with me? 2 hours, Jeff, I think, trying to make me into an engineer, utilities engineer. I still don't know that I'm there, but at least you gave me some interesting anecdotes that I think I can describe it a little more effectively.
Could you do that a little bit just so it's a little bit easier to grasp what you're talking about? In terms of understanding the cogeneration?
The cogeneration is what we do is we burn a fuel and make steam. If you sent that steam, for example, the City of Ames power plant, all that steam goes to make electricity. That process is not very efficient, 35% efficient. The best conventional power plants are 42%. The reason for that is when the steam goes through the turbine to make electricity, it comes out of the turbine at a low temperature. You can't do much with it, so it's condensed and that energy is lost. For us, the steam goes through the turbine, makes electricity, and then we send it out to the campus, and it's used to heat the buildings. So rather than losing that energy, it's used, improves our efficiency. Last year, our plant averaged 60% efficiency for the year. So what that means is we're burning less fuel to provide the same amount of energy, and by burning less fuel, there are less emissions, less pollution, if you want to call it that, that results from that.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a very efficient process. The original power plant was designed by professors.
Mm-hmm.
And operated by professors, I believe, at
that
time.
Oh, really? Oh, that's so interesting.
So, you know, it's a good technology. It's very proven. The technology has changed, but the thermodynamic efficiency is the same.
Hmm.
Yeah, and the other thing I think is very interesting, too, that adds to the efficiency of the power plant, Jeff, as I understand, is the type of boilers that we have within the power plant. So we have some fluidized bed boilers. In fact, I think they're all moving that way, if I'm correct. And so could you describe that a little bit more? And then I can tell you the anecdote that I use all the time, so you can tell me if that's correct.
When the university started, EPA didn't exist. There were no environmental regulations or anything like that.
EPA is Environmental Protection Agency.
Correct. That changed for the university in 1970 when the Clean Air Act was passed and the plant started modifying itself to comply with new regulations. We needed to replace some boilers in the mid-80s. We researched the technologies and selected fluidized bed boilers because of their efficiency and because of their environmental performance. Those boilers burn coal along with limestone. The limestone reacts with the sulfur that's in the coal, and we can remove 90% of the sulfur emissions. So they're very good from an environmental standpoint, very efficient, and they've been our primary units. The plant is changing now even more with new regulatory requirements. Our older coal boilers weren't as efficient, weren't as nearly as good environmentally. They have been replaced with natural gas boilers. So we're transitioning a portion of the plant to natural gas.
And that has already happened?
It is essentially done. The new boilers are operational. We'll do our final testing next month. Pretty much we are finishing the project right now. When we're done here, the plant will be 40% coal capacity, 60% natural gas capacity. And the reason for keeping the two fuels was, number one, the fluidized bed boilers could comply with these new regulations fairly easily, but the older boilers couldn't.
And those were stoker boilers,
those
right?
Those were coal stoker boilers from the 70s and late 60s and 70s. Mm-hmm. And so we could comply. That gives us two fuel choices. Right now, natural gas is very cheap. 3-4 years ago, it was twice the cost of coal. So it gives us flexibility to minimize the operating cost for the university by choosing which fuel makes the most economic sense and environmental sense as well.
And isn't it true, too, Jeff, that the flexibility of still maintaining the fluidized bed boilers allows us to – I know you've done test burning for wood – allows us to look at other biomass sources. So we have that flexibility if something like that becomes available, that we can utilize that as well. We're not just necessarily stuck on natural gas or coal or some of those things. That other universities are making the complete move to natural gas, right?
Right. Natural gas boilers pretty much can only burn natural gas. Coal boilers, you can blend – different types of biomasses with them to certain percentages. It depends on the biomass and burn a more sustainable fuel. We've tested wood pellets and wood chips and actually have a permit that will allow us to burn up to 15% wood in those boilers. It's more expensive fuel today, so we haven't done it. We continue to look at opportunities, lots of opportunities out there for biomass, but we have to balance costs with the environmental benefit.
What I like in the fluidized bed boilers to be is like an air popcorn popper. This isn't one of the pieces related to the fluidized bed boiler, the fact that the fuel is actually almost elevated through an air current to get the most thermal energy out of that fuel possible. Is that correct?
That is correct. It's if you could look inside the boiler, it would look like a boiling pan of soup inside. Because of that, there's very good mixing. You get very good combustion of the fuel. You get very good reaction with the limestone and that we add for sulfur removal. Very good mixing and reaction there, so it minimizes the emissions.
So is this water boiling, or what is it? What is the liquid?
It's a solid.
But it looks like soup?
Yeah.
Soup is liquid.
It's a solid. It's what we call bed material, and it's a blend of coal, ash, and limestone. It's all very fine, but it's just... you're blowing it on a bed of air, and it's just bubbling around in there.
Wow.
And we can control the combustion temperature very closely to maximize that reaction with the limestone. Mm-hmm. And that also minimizes emissions of other pollutants. So that's all inherent in the boilers. Then the boilers have a filter on the outlet of the boiler to filter out all the ash that takes out 99.5% of the ash. So it's they're very, very good from an environmental standpoint.
Yeah, and that's versus a stoker, which literally you just sort of, you know, it's, I think it's what we traditionally think of when we think of, you know, coal burning, for the non-engineers, of course, that you're throwing these piles of coal in, and then you sort of are igniting them from the bottom up, and then they burn what they can. So like in our fireplaces, if you still have a wood fireplace, which we do, at the end of burning, we still have kind of those chunks of wood that haven't necessarily burned, and we want to make sure we're using as much of the fuel as possible. And so that's what the fluidized bed boiler, air popcorn popper for me, because I'm with you, Ursula. I'm thinking soup. What kind of liquid's in there? So, but anyway, I think that's just such a unique way of really looking at the full circle effect of what we do.
You know, the stoker boilers had no means of controlling sulfur or those kind of things either, so the pollution levels were higher.
Sure.
When we finish this project, we expect emissions from the plant to drop more than 80%, even though we're still burning coal.
80%?
Yeah.
That's huge.
And still burning coal on the fluidized beds, but they do very well. So it's a very good thing.
Yeah, so doing the best, you know, we can do with the technologies and within those budgets. You know, if we had all the money in the world, the things that we would be able to choose to do, right? Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's balancing all of those pieces. Similar to sustainability, you look at the environmental, the social, and the economic pieces as well. So certainly that's a piece of the consideration.
Mm-hmm. You had mentioned, Mary, that there is an event coming up to celebrate power. At ISU?
Well, actually, we have a number of events coming up during Earth Week, but one that I really wanted to highlight because Jeff was here is related to the number of years we've been doing cogeneration at Iowa State, and also highlighting the great vision, I think, and forward movement that we're always continuing to look at taking related to how we produce power and the renovation of the power plant. So I don't know, Jeff, do you want to give a little bit more information about specifically what's happening in the renovation?
Okay.
I know you mentioned the boiler transfer, but
The renovation basically is replacing our old stoker boilers with new efficient gas boilers. It did modify the fluidized beds boilers slightly to reduce emissions even farther to meet the new requirements, and built an addition on the plant, and we're removing all of the old coal equipment and stuff off the plant that was needed for coal on the stoker boilers. The new boilers are designed specifically to maximize efficiency and give us more operational flexibility to reduce costs for campus.
Right. And carbon emissions, the carbon footprint, we hear about that all the time. What kind of carbon – I think this is so impressive. The carbon emission reduction that's going to come just from the renovation.
Will be about a 15% reduction in CO2 emissions. And like I said earlier, 80% reduction in other emissions like sulfur and NOx emissions and those kind of things. So it's a good thing for us, and it should allow us to improve the power plant efficiency even more than the 60% we were last year.
That's great. So the event is when?
The event is April 21st from 1 to 4 p.m., and it's an open house for the plant. And the reason for the event is in 2016, we've been doing cogeneration for 125 years. So it's a 125th anniversary, as well as an opportunity to showcase the new addition and the new equipment and that type of thing. So it'll be an open house, open to the public. There'll be tours. There'll be displays.
So you'll see the soup?
You really can't see inside the boiler.
Okay.
We can look inside a gas boiler, but we can't look inside the coal boiler.
Yes.
I want to see the soup.
A few more risk management pieces with that, right, Jeff? Yeah. Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. Any last words before we wrap things up?
You know, from a sustainability perspective, you know, we're making a lot of good changes here. We do buy wind energy from a wind farm up by Zirion, Iowa.
We can see the windmill here at Iowa State, too.
And we have
a
wind turbine on campus, and there are now solar panels right next to the wind turbine providing some solar energy into campus. So we're dabbling in renewable energy, and really, you know, the campus wind turbine and solar panels are more there for demonstration. They're not huge.
So you're getting energy from wind turbines outside of town, too?
Correct. Up by Zirion is there. And we're partnered with the city of Ames in buying wind energy off the grid. But it's research opportunities And the data is available on websites so people can see how wind turbines perform, how solar panels perform, that type of thing. So,
it's a great experience for our students to get up close and personal to some of those pieces. And because we are in Ames, city proper, the university is, there are regulations related to us being able to have a production size wind turbine in town. So mm-hmm. we're very fortunate that we've got this very close source mm-hmm. of wind energy. And I really credit Jeff and his team because they're always looking at different opportunities, really monitoring how the production is going with the renewable sources, looking at where we may capitalize on increasing those sources and those opportunities. So I think we've got a great team powering Sci.
Our staff are dedicated to maximizing the plant efficiency and being mm-hmm. reliable mm-hmm. and minimizing cost to campus. That's what they do every day. Mm-hmm. And they're always looking for opportunities to make things better.
Right. So it's really a profession where there's always growth, isn't there, and change for you.
That is correct. Mm-hmm. That is correct.
Is there a website where people can go to look at the wind turbine and other aspects of energy at Iowa State?
Yes. If you go to the Facilities Planning and Management website, which is www.fpm.iastate.edu, there's a link there for utilities that has information on the renewable energy, has information on utility usages for campus, information on all the buildings and the energy that all the buildings are using, because we meter all the buildings, so we know what's going on campus with all the buildings.
And there's a great energy dashboard that we've recently put together that really gets down into all the specifics related to the energy that we use, how our buildings are performing, which I think for a non-engineer, it's really easy to understand. So there's a whole lot of great information for engineered types as well. So that's a nice balance.
Very nice. Well, the clock is telling us we have to wrap up. So you have been listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, and I'm your host for today, Ursula Rudenberg, and we're speaking here about energy and how it's produced and managed at Iowa State University with Mary Rankin, Director of Sustainability at Iowa State University, and Jeff Witt, who is the ISU Utilities Director. Thank you for coming today, and look forward to seeing you next month, Mary.
Yeah, thanks so much. It was great. Have a great day.
Thanks for the opportunity.
You. And earlier we spoke with Lindsay Nissen about the Reliable Street Project, so we're talking about a lot of tall buildings right now and with some history in the area. Plan to come to KHOI's Third Thursday Live Cafe, which is Thursday the 17th at KHOI at 410 Douglas Avenue here, and enjoy shoegaze music by Liana and be part of our live audience for this on-air concert. A brief announcement about upcoming classes at Legacy Learning during the next 2 weekends. Legacy Learning is a learning center in the Boone River Valley that has opportunities for artistic getaways. And tomorrow, Saturday, March 12th, there's a day-long workshop on basic welding skills for sculpture in Webster City, taught by Doug Abbott. And on Sunday, there'll be a workshop which will allow you to create your own sculpture. And for information, go to legacylearningbrv.org. And the next weekend, March 19th and 20th, there's a 2-day workshop on watercolor called Celebrate the Life and Nature in Vibrant Color, taught by award-winning artist Marcia Anderson. Again, that website to find out more is legacylearningbrv.org. Local Talk is a radio production training workshop as well as a radio show. So if you'd like to join our team as a reporter, contact us at 292-2878 or through our website, khoifm.org. Local Talk is engineered by Jonah DeGeese today. Thank you, Jonah. Our theme song, as always, is Backtrackin' by Tom Richards and Al Harris from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. We also heard an original song about the Skunk River by Lindsay Nissen. KHOI is streaming online at khoifm.org, and you can also listen to this show and all of our past Local Talk shows online on our website, khoifm.org, and you can find today's show on our homepage as soon as our webmaster, Ron Carson, is able to post it. Thank you, Ron. Please remember that you as the listener are the most important part of Local Talk. Your participation as the audience is what makes this all possible and meaningful. KHOI is moving on up. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you again on the radio.